You're listening to TIP.
We look for students that are entrepreneurial. We don't care what their GPA is. We don't care what their major is. It literally makes no difference. We just want someone that has made a dollar with entrepreneurship before. We don't even care. We just want them to have that gene. We can't make them an entrepreneur and we don't want to try. So they have to have the gene. Furthermore, we want them to have three qualities. We want them to be humble, just willing to learn, a sponge, moldable. We want them to be grateful. Just grateful for the opportunity. There's a direct correlation between kids that are really grateful to have been chosen and their success. And then the third is energy. We want them to have high energy. So if they meet those criteria, then we give them three business ideas to choose from. We give them a salary, we give them a timeline, and we fund the idea itself. And we take majority equity in the business. And then we just hold their hand and we tell them exactly what to do and how to start it and how to be successful.
Hey guys, in this week's episode, I had the pleasure of sitting down and talking with Chris Kerner to talk about his holding company, Co-Founders, and the unique way he launches new entrepreneurial ventures. You also hear what it was like for Chris to be a missionary for 2 years in Hungary, a crazy story about partnering with John McAfee, how he got involved in Bitcoin mining, his experience doing ultra marathons, why living organ donoring has become an important topic to him, and a whole lot more. Chris has started over 20 different companies and currently runs a holding company called Co-Founders. He started and sold 5 7- to 8-figure businesses in 5 different industries and loves the game of business. I love doing this episode with Chris. He's a super fascinating guy that's done so many things in and out of business, and I think you guys are really going to enjoy this episode. And so without further delay, let's dive into today's episode with Chris Kerner.
Celebrating 10 years, you are listening to Millennial Investing by the Investors Podcast Network. Since 2014, we interviewed successful entrepreneurs, business leaders, and investors to help educate and inspire the millennial generation. Now for your host, Patrick Donnelly.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Millennial Investing Podcast. I'm your host today, Patrick Donnelly. And joining me in the studio today is Mr. Chris Kerner. Chris, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks, Patrick. Thanks for having me.
I am really happy to have you on today. I've been spending a lot of time the last couple of days just learning about you, reading all your content you've got on Twitter. You've got an amazing story. And there's so many directions I could go right now, but I wanted to start off with being a missionary in Hungary. I wanted to talk about that, hear about that, and just some of the lessons you learned, like being a missionary and knocking on doors.
Yeah, absolutely. So I am a member of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, commonly known as the Mormons. And as most people know, we send 18 to 19-year-olds out across the whole world for 18 to 24 months to serve others and to talk about our church. So I got sent to Hungary. We don't choose where we go. We just kind of fill out an application. I get a medical screening and submit it, and then we're told where we're going. And so I went to Hungary in 2006 to 2008.
So tell me about that. You're there. What's an average day look like when you're canvassing, basically, right? And teaching people about, you know, you're getting a lot of doors shut in your face, I would imagine.
Vast majority. Yeah. The average day, you wake up at 6:30. You will read your scriptures for a half hour or maybe even an hour by yourself. And then you'll read your scriptures with your companion for 30 to 60 minutes. And then you'll go work out for 30 to 60 minutes. Maybe it's lift weights. Maybe it's you go on a run. And then you plan your day. That takes about a half hour. And then you hit the streets. And that looks differently based on where you are. If you're in Provo, Utah, then you're probably not canvassing at all. You're just handling referrals from other members of the church. If you're in Budapest, Hungary, you're probably knocking doors or going to a busy city center and just approaching people on the street.
So you obviously learned Hungarian before you took off. Is that how it worked? You studied the language and then were sent there?
So everyone goes to what's called the Missionary Training Center. There's about 15 of them worldwide, the biggest being in Provo, Utah. And that's where you learn the language, if you will be speaking a different language. And it's just where you learn how to be a missionary. And you're there for a minimum, depending on where you're going, a minimum of 2 weeks to a maximum of, it used to be 12, and today it's closer to 9. And so depending on how hard the language is, depends on, that determines how long you're in the MTC for. So I was in there for the maximum amount of time, which was 12 weeks.
And you're fluent in the language now?
I was, but you know, there are not a lot of opportunities to practice Hungarian in Dallas, Texas. I can understand it much, much better than I can speak it. I've been back to the country twice since coming home in 08, and it's tough. Like, it's really tough because you just hear it and you're like, okay, yeah. And then you just go to respond and it's just like spaghetti. You can't get it out.
So did you meet and become really close friends with Hungarians while you were there? I mean, people maybe that you who did open their door to you and were able to listen?
Yeah. I mean, we were immersed. At the time, you only called home twice per year. Christmas, and Mother's Day. And you would write letters or emails once per week. Today, it's different. You can call home every Monday, but it was different back then. And the idea was to be completely immersed. Like, you are one of them. You don't have a job. You don't have hobbies. You are a full-time missionary.
I think I heard you say, aren't more people not able to complete their assignment now? Like, they not that they become softer, but like, it's harder to complete the assignment. Is that accurate to say?
Yeah, this is more of me speaking candidly and off the record as a general observer of trends in my church and just kind of a nerdy stats guy. These numbers aren't published anywhere, so I don't know for sure. But anecdotally, it's been pretty well documented that call it 10 to 20% of missionaries go home early today. Whereas, and once again, I don't represent the church. These numbers aren't published anywhere. I don't even know if they're true. This is just my total guess. But it used to be closer to low single digits, 1 to 5%. No one really knows why. My guess, my complete hunch is that, you know, social media and smartphones changed everything. And it's just a much bigger shock to the culture and the system to go from constantly connected to not connected at all. And so it's actually really interesting because that trend is reversing and you're hearing much less missionaries come home early. And I think, once again, totally guessing, that we're just becoming acclimated to it. Like, it's, this is the new norm. And it's like, you saw this distribution curve and everyone kind of freaked out and they left their friends and they were off Instagram and off Facebook. And now it's like the church has done a better job at preparing missionaries. And I think, you know, maybe 5 years ago, an 18 or 19 year old leave home addicted to their phone, addicted to social media, and that was taken away completely. Whereas now, phones are so normal, that age of, you know, missionaries are actually less addicted to their phone than maybe even a millennial, right? Like, because they're so used to it, they're better able to manage it, I should say. So when they step away from it, they're better able to manage their lives. That's just a guess.
So you were what, 18 to 20 when you did this?
19 to 21 at the time, and today it's 18 to 21.
I wanted to talk about prior to that, I wanted to get into kind of your early hustles. You had a guy named Danny that you worked with. I want to hear about Danny and some of the lessons that you learned from him.
Yeah, Danny was a great guy. He was the father to my wrestling partner, Robert. He was from New Jersey. He was a hustler, just a New Jersey entrepreneur, hustler, had started and owned restaurants and pest control companies and you name it. He was just a slick talker, great at, you know, taking something for a dollar and selling it for two. And I worked for him. And at the time, it's just like, yeah, it was my job. I push a spreader all summer. I spray houses. But then a decade later, I look back and I was like, that's where I learned business. Like, that's like, I was immersed in business for 4 years. That's why I am who I am, because of that experience with Danny.
And he had like a unique billboard sign. Didn't he have like some kind of funky sign up that it was voted like the eyesore in the town?
Yeah, I was in Titusville, Florida, is where I grew up. And he had a company called Quantum Pest Control. And right there on US 1, next to the Indian River, there was a big billboard that had his logo, Quantum. And then it was just a massive toothbrush with a massive cockroach on top of bristles that said got bugs. That's it. No number, just the logo and the words got bugs. And that drove all of his business. And I just thought that was brilliant.
And someday you may do a pest control company in the holding company?
Well, who knows? I'm not against any company.
Yeah.
I love all business. I would use that billboard for sure.
Yeah, it was cool. If people haven't seen it on Twitter, it's worth checking out. I wanted to talk too about your writing and this woman, I think maybe in high school, that inspired you, Jane Spiedel. You're a really great writer. Like, your content, I really appreciate it and appreciate good writing. And I wanted to hear about Jane Spiedel and just how you got started writing.
Thank you. I appreciate that. She was my yearbook advisor. And I joined yearbook just because it was another class. And I tweeted about this, but I had an assignment to write about a part of the school that I had to go observe for an hour. And she was very dramatic. She was just, I don't know, there's no other word for it. She was very dramatic. She was extra. And so I wrote this very sarcastic essay about the beauty of the orchestra room. And I just made it, I was being sarcastic. And she took it seriously and she loved it and it touched her. And that made me the assistant executive editor based on that one essay, which meant that I became the executive editor the next year of my senior year.
So that's kind of where you started to hone your craft of writing?
Yeah. And then, you know, I started starting businesses and my writing kind of changed to be more copywriting to convince people to buy things. And I never really took a course or read a book. I just kind of learned from what I saw in ads that seemed to work and copied and changed to fit my own needs.
Yeah. So now you're doing a newsletter. You post on Twitter frequently. I wanted to hear a little bit about how Twitter has affected your career.
Yeah. So I feel like I'm still in the very early days of Twitter. I've only been posting consistently there for like 15 months. I had another stint on Twitter a few years ago. That was a completely different experience. I have a lot of experience writing or posting stuff to Twitter, but only about 15 or 16 months of doing long form, kind of intentional, thoughtful content on Twitter on my current account. And the jury's still out on how much of an effect it will have on my businesses, because I'm not really actively promoting things, but it's just brought some incredible opportunities and people into my orbit that's hard to quantify.
Nick Huber, the sweaty startup guy, he talks about writing being a superpower. And I think there's a lot of truth to that. Like there's, for some reason, people that can write, we kind of put them up on a pedestal and look at them like this guy. And yeah, I think it's a great skill to have and anybody ought to develop it. Are you a big reader?
Not as much lately. I used to be, but I just haven't dedicated much time to it over the last few years. But I think what is unique about my Twitter content is a lot of times you have people that can write really well, but they're not actually doing things in life or in business that are worth writing about. They're good at putting words together. They know all the skills. They've taken a course. They've read the books, but they're just writing about kind of surface level fluff or regurgitating stuff that they're reading in those books. And then you have people that are doing really cool things in business or in entrepreneurship, but they're not really good at writing about it, or they don't care to write about it. Could be excellent writers, but they're just not on social media, which is great. More power to them. And I think I'm different in that I'm doing both, right? I'm actually doing things. I'm starting companies. I have real experiences and I don't mind being transparent about them because there's no one to fire me. I'm not controversial. So there's no fear of like getting canceled. So I'm just kind of taking actually what I'm doing and then taking some writing skills and putting them together.
Nick had the same point that you got to be doing interesting things in order to post good content. And I wanted to get into the companies that you're running. You've got a holding company called Co-Founders. So tell me about that. And then just like some of the companies that are within the holding company and the one or two that you're like most excited about right now.
Yeah. So Co-Founders is comprised of a company called Mining Syndicate, which is where I'm sitting today. It is a company that sells crypto mining hardware and services like hosting and software as well. So we're basically a data center for crypto miners, but we get most of our revenue from selling the hardware, not the services. And then I have a company called Texas Snacks, and we resell Buc-ee's products. Buc-ee's being a 50 chain kind of mega gas station. It's like the Disney of gas stations. That's a whole, you know, story in and of itself. And then I have a company called Fast Tree Care, which we started last summer with an operator. And that's just a boring old tree trimming business. That's a lot of fun. And we have a company called Volterra, which is an AI software that helps skilled nursing facilities find more medical codes to bill for. That's pre-revenue. We're about to go live with our first handful of customers. And then we own an RV park in Waco, Texas. Just a simple RV park, small one. And then we are constantly incubating/working on 3 to 5 other projects. Some of them may never launch. Some of them could be really big businesses.
So let's go into that a little bit. I know you'll partner with MBAs and business students, things like that. Talk to me about that process. If there's somebody listening right now that is intrigued by what you're up to and wants to get involved, like how do you vet people? How do you split equity? Like how does the whole thing work?
Yeah. So our job, quote, our position is posted on hundreds of universities across the country. And so we look for students that are entrepreneurial. We don't care where they live. We don't care what their GPA is. We don't care what their major is. It literally makes no difference. We just want someone that has made a dollar with entrepreneurship before. Maybe it was a lemonade stand. Maybe it was a massive company. We don't even care. We just want them to have that gene. We can't make them an entrepreneur and we don't want to try. So they have to have the gene. Furthermore, we want them to have three qualities. We want them to be humble, just willing to learn, a sponge, moldable. We want them to be grateful, just grateful for the opportunity. There's a direct correlation between kids that are really grateful to have been chosen and their success. And then the third is energy. We want them to have high energy. They could be introverted. That's fine. I am as well. But we just want them to be excited. We want to hang up with them and then just feel energized from the conversation. So if they meet those criteria, then we give them three business ideas to choose from. We give them a salary. We give them a timeline and we fund the idea itself. And we take majority equity in the business, maybe 51%, maybe 70%. And then we just hold their hand and we tell them exactly what to do and how to start it and how to be successful.
It sounds awesome. It's such a good idea. And these are all college age kids for the most part. You're not hiring people that are further along in their career, correct?
Correct. Yep.
Yeah. Those three qualities you listed, Warren Buffett's got a similar thing of like what he looks for in managers and leaders. And it's a very similar list.
I heard that just recently. And I think one or two of them, there was some overlap. I think integrity was one.
Integrity, energy are definitely two of them. I like the humility and the gratefulness. That's just being teachable, being a learner. Yeah, those are huge. So let's go into, you had mentioned Buc-ee's. I'm from Columbus, Ohio. I had mentioned earlier, I really hadn't heard of Buc-ee's up until a few months ago. And I saw it on Twitter, maybe through you, maybe through Michael Girdley. I'm not sure exactly, but tell me about Texas Snacks, Buc-ee's, and what you're doing with that portion of the company.
Yeah. So Buc-ee's is, like I said, it's a massive gas station. They're 60,000 square feet. They have over 100. If you drive by one, you will have remembered it. They started in Texas. They opened their first one outside of Texas in Alabama. And now they're in about a dozen states or so, but opening more every quarter or two. And they're very unique. They just have an amazing brand. It's this cartoonish beaver. And I don't know what they did, but they tapped into something magical to where if you go to a Buc-ee's, you have to talk about it. You have to fall in love with it. And you just love it. It's just an amazing experience.
What is it about it? I mean, I've never been to one, obviously. So what is it about it? What have they done right that taps into this customer love that gets created?
Well, I think a lot of it is confirmation bias. So they have a great brand. And so I think a lot of people that go there have already heard about it. And they've heard good things. So they're expecting a great experience. And then, you know, there's 100 gas pumps and it's just unusual. So they walk in with this wide-eyed wonder. And then you walk in and it's just busy. It's just got good energy. Everyone's friendly. They're known for their bathrooms. Their bathrooms are spotless, super nice. And then they have a full restaurant in there serving Texas barbecue. And they just have a whole wall of jerky, a whole wall of candy, thousands of snacks, all like a lot of unique products or items that you couldn't find anywhere else. And it's just a great experience. That's what it is. It's an experience. It's not a gas station. It's closer to Disney than a gas station.
So your idea was to sell Buc-ee's products. So talk to me about that because they originally said no to you, right?
Yeah. Well, they originally ignored me. And so I went to a Buc-ee's and just out of curiosity, I pulled up their website on my phone and they didn't sell online. And that boggled my mind. At this time, they probably had 30 locations. Each location does guesstimated between like 20 and 30 million a year. So we're talking, you know, $500 million company plus at the time. And they didn't sell online. And you go there for the snacks, but they also have all this merch, like dozens of different shirts and really, you know, cute looking clothes that particularly women love to wear. And nothing was online. And so at this time, I owned a third party logistics company that e-commerce brands would outsource their fulfillment operations to us. And so I thought, man, Buc-ee's could be a great customer to us. So let's try to snag them. So I started emailing the executive team saying, hey, we have this company called Send Eats and we can manage all of your e-commerce, you know, white glove. We'll put up your website. We'll do everything for you. Let us know. No response. Crickets. And so I just thought, this needs to happen. I'm going to do this myself. I'll do it for them. And so I looked into it. I was like, all right, am I going to get sued here? And there's this law called first sale doctrine, which states that anyone can sell whatever they want. They just can't pretend to be another brand. So I can resell Buc-ee's stuff just like I can resell my iPhone. I just can't pretend to be Apple. And so we launched a website. We called it Beaver Snacks at the time because that's their mascot is a beaver. And we put a big disclaimer saying we're not Buc-ee's. We're buying and then reselling their products with a markup. So we launched. I took my family to Buc-ee's. We bought one of everything. It was like $2,000 or $3,000. Everyone was looking at us sideways. They didn't know what to think of us because they had never seen this before. And brought it back to our warehouse, hired a photographer, took pictures of everything, put it on a website. And then I started emailing reporters. And I just said, hey, this is who I am. This is what we're doing. We're launching a business. We want to get Bucky's attention. So I didn't tell reporters this, but internally I'm thinking, worst case, they say, this is not okay. We're going to sue you. And even if they have no grounds to sue us, we'll just shut it down because I don't want to mess with that. Best case, they say, hey, we'll partner with you. Or best case, it's, hey, we will partner with you, but you know, you now have a profitable company. And so I emailed reporters and I was on the phone with a lawyer by the end of the day, the Bucky's in-house counsel. And he said, listen, we don't mind what you're doing. We have no interest in selling online. We don't mind if you do, but please make a few changes. We don't want you to use the word Beaver because it's confusing. Change the name. More disclaimers. Make the disclaimer easier to read. And you have our blessing.
Let's take a quick break and hear from today's sponsors.
Hey, everyone. It's Patrick, your host of Millennial Investing. Every year, my buddies and I do a guys trip to escape the cold and dreary Ohio winters. Once we pick our destination, without fail, we all jump on Airbnb and find an incredible place to stay. We just got back from an amazing trip in Palm Springs, California, and our Airbnb home was a huge part of creating memories we'll never forget. I loved it so much, I'm taking my family back to Palm Springs for spring break, and we're staying in an Airbnb home my kids fell in love with and picked out themselves. While I was there, I had the realization that my own home could be an Airbnb. It's an excellent way to earn some extra cash, whether you're saving up for your next vacation, paying off some bills, or investing. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host. That's airbnb.com/host. Do you guys ever feel overwhelmed with all that's going on in the markets and feel like you just can't keep up with the day-to-day news headlines? Today's show sponsor, Yahoo Finance, is my go-to solution to keeping up with today's top news and stay informed with what is happening globally. With Yahoo Finance, I'm able to see the biggest trends and biggest movers in the stock market, what is happening with interest rates, major geopolitical events, and much more. If it wasn't for Yahoo Finance, I would have no idea that Tesla is laying off 10% of their staff or why iPhone shipments are down 9% year over year. Yahoo Finance also has a number of other cool features, including a tool that lets you link in all of your investment accounts, analyst ratings and independent research, as well as the ability to create customized charts. Yahoo Finance is one of my favorite tools I use in my investing toolkit, and it's what I use each morning to kick off my day and stay in the loop with what's happening in the markets. Join more than 90 million monthly users today and get comprehensive financial news and analysis at yahoofinance.com. The number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.
Buy low, sell high. It's easy to say, hard to do. For example, high interest rates are crushing the real estate market right now. Demand is dropping and prices are falling, even for many of the best assets. It's no wonder the Fundrise flagship fund plans to go on a buying spree, expanding its billion-dollar real estate portfolio over the next few months. You can add the Fundrise flagship fund to your portfolio in just minutes and with as little as $10 by visiting fundrise.com/millennialinvesting. Carefully consider the investment objectives, risks, charges, and expenses of the Fundrise flagship fund before investing. This and other information can be found in the fund's prospectus at fundrise.com/flagship. This is a paid advertisement. All right, back to the show.
Why do you think they had no interest in doing it themselves? Seems like it's a, I don't know what the revenue would have been, but it's got to be a decent chunk of change you're giving up.
Yeah, I think that they're trying to optimize for the in-store experience. I don't know this. They haven't told me this, but my hunch is that they think it would cannibalize their in-store sales or incentivize people to not come to the store. And I think they want the Bucky's experience to stay exclusive and elusive and unique. Whereas if you can just click and order it, then it's, even if their sales go up and even if it doesn't hurt their in-store sales, it's just not as much of a novelty.
So you're going directly to the stores each week or a couple times a week to buy merchandise to then sell online. Is that how the logistics of it work?
Yeah. So we have pretty close relationships with the general managers of two different stores and then decent relationships with two other stores as well. And so we will place an order beforehand and they will receive it from their distribution center, palletize our order, let us know when it's ready. And then we will show up We'll make sure everything's in there. And then we'll go to the front counter with everyone else. They will kind of portion off our line, our aisle, and we'll swipe that card for tens of thousands of dollars and then load it up in our box truck and drive it to the warehouse.
That's incredible. All developed because you already were doing, it's called 3PL, right? Third party logistics. You were already doing this for other food companies, right? Like ice cream and candy bar, whatever, you know, like you were already doing that, right?
Yeah. I mean, we didn't need that. We could have done it from our house if we wanted. It just made it a lot more convenient. We already had software. We had the skills. I have an e-commerce background, so it made it a lot easier. But funny enough, like after 2 years of doing both the Texas snacks company that we owned and the e-commerce fulfillment for other brands, we just looked at our financials every month and said, man, this 3PL stuff does not make any money. This is such a hard business. It's the high margin for error. Let's just fire our customers and only do the Bucky stuff. And so we did.
So the company, the holding company's co-founders, do you have partners? I know you're partnering with the college kids that we mentioned, but do you also have a partner that, you know, is like your Charlie Munger, your right-hand man that is bouncing off these ideas and figuring out what to pursue?
Yeah. His name's Nick Huleski, and he was one of my mission companions in Hungary. He was my first. So they call that your trainer. So he helped me learn Hungarian, and we've been best friends for like 18 years now, ever since.
You talked about a little bit about like the entrepreneurial gene. Do you think that's something that's like innate in people, or do you think it can develop?
I think it could be either or. For me, it was developed. It doesn't run in my family at all. I grew up poor. I lived across the street from a golf course, and my first business was selling golf balls. That would land in my yard and in the ditch across the street. And I would go gather them up and put them in a Red Ryder wagon and wash them and walk them to the clubhouse and sell them in the parking lot until the owner would yell at me. That was out of necessity because there was no money for a yearbook or for candy or for a bike.
You had to earn it if you wanted it, right?
I had to earn it. Yeah.
Do you do that with your own kids? So yeah. If they want something, you put the onus on them to...
No. So they do chores. They all have like a chore chart. And they earn money and they can buy whatever they want with that. But it's not like super hardcore. You know, we also buy them things. What I was saying yes to is that all four of our kids are very entrepreneurial. My wife is entrepreneurial as well. It is in our DNA as a family. So for them, it's nature and nurture.
Right.
Maybe it was just nurture.
And so are they working in some of the companies that you've got going? Do you put them to work like doing fulfillment or?
From time to time. They'll do fulfillment for Texas Snacks, not super often, but really it's more of they sell stuff at school and we help them with that. My daughter will make bracelets. My kids will go to Winco, which is like a budget grocery store where you can buy candy by the pound. And I'll give them like a $5 budget and we'll do competitions so they can see who can turn that $5 into the most amount of money at school by reselling the candy.
I think I heard you said you do something similar with like a Robinhood account, right? Like they trade and you have a competition to see who can trade. And
we did that once with crypto, actually, just for fun. And it was bad timing. None of them did well.
It was when things were collapsing.
Yeah. Yeah.
Let's get into that. I wanted to hear about, you've got some great stories about John McAfee of McAfee Security fame. Very fascinating guy. I think you had mentioned they're making a movie about his life. Tell me about how you got connected with him and just like that entire story.
That's a long story. So I'll give you the highlights. And that is 2017. Crypto was just booming. Bitcoin was going from 3,000 to 20,000 over the course of 2 months. And I was deeply entrenched in all of that. I first bought Bitcoin in 2016, and I'd just been curious with it. And so I had a thesis in 2017 that crypto altcoin specifically, so everything aside from Bitcoin and Ethereum, I had a thesis that these prices were driven by hype. And I wasn't a genius. A lot of people thought that, but my thesis was that this would be measurable. And so I kind of developed an algorithm that took the hype of an altcoin, which was derived from how many social media mentions and, you know, mentions on Twitter and on Reddit and all those platforms. I would make a hype score and I would divide it against the market cap. So if a token had a really high market cap and no one was talking about it, then my algorithm would say short. And if, you know, it had a very low market cap and everyone was talking about it, it would say buy. And I put this together and then I started tracking it and it worked. And I thought, wow, this could be huge. This is really big. I found alpha. And, you know, to find alpha in the stock market is impossible.
Hard to do.
In crypto, why not? So I was a nobody on social media. I had no following.
And this was 2017, correct?
17. Yep. Late 2017.
Good timing.
Yep. And so, well, in a sense, bad timing in another sense, because it was all about to crash. But I thought, okay, I need to reach out to John McAfee because he was the biggest influencer on crypto Twitter at the time. He had about 800,000 followers. And so he's notoriously unreachable. I tried to guess his email to no success until finally I did. I used an app to see if he would open my emails, and he finally opened it, but he wouldn't respond. So I just kept emailing saying, John, I've got something big I want to show you. He finally responded, and he was very critical, very, you know, standoffish, said, I don't believe you. And I said, let me show you in person. I thought if I could present in person, then he'll buy into it. So he finally said, yes. He said, come to my house in Tennessee. And so I flew to Alabama. I stayed at a friend's house in Northern Alabama. And then I drove up to his house, and he had said, I'll send you my address the morning of. So I started driving to his city, which is Lexington, and he wouldn't respond to my email. I didn't have his address until like the last minute he gave me his address. So I showed up, and he wanted me to show up at 1:23 p.m. And this was late February 2018 at this point. And I presented this to him, and it was a wild, it was wild. He had a whole camera crew from Australia there. He had bodyguards. He had assault rifles laying on the ground. It was everything you'd imagine. And I presented this to him, and he loved it. He understood it immediately. And he said, what do you need from me? And we launched a company together.
That's crazy. And how did it unfold from there?
Yeah. So I asked him to tweet about me twice per week, and I would give him a quarter of the profits. And the whole play was to start a free community for people that wanted access to these altcoin picks. And then to, you know, once they started relying on it and investing in it and liking it, to start charging for full access to all of the picks. And so we did. We launched a Discord community. We had tens of thousands of members. He would tweet about me twice per week. He did everything he said he would do. We ended up launching a token, and it grew to a 30-something million-dollar market cap. We were listed on a dozen major exchanges, and then the market just started crashing. I mean, it was crashing the whole time, but you couldn't tell. We thought it was just dipping temporarily. Turned out to be a two-year bear market, and we just fought that the whole time. And so our market cap dropped, people would leave the community, and it ended up just kind of dying a slow death.
It's such a good story, actually. I remember that time, 2017. He could move a market with a single tweet.
Yeah, he could. We were always very careful about that. We didn't have an ICO. We didn't want to sell any tokens. We didn't want him to really move the market. And he ended up getting in trouble for a lot of those tweets.
Yeah, I mean, he ended up going to prison, right? I mean, he's since passed away, but I think, didn't he get put in prison for tax fraud or tax evasion?
Tax fraud, yeah.
Yeah. Did you have any trepidation going into business with him? Were you like, this guy, you seem like the antithesis of him. Like, you're this Mormon guy, right? Yeah, he is the exact opposite, drinking and party, you know, like just seems like a wild lifestyle that he's led. It just seems like there couldn't be two different partners.
I did. We were very different. Yeah. And I wanted to keep it more of it like a business owner slash influencer relationship as opposed to a business partner relationship. And so I call him a partner in the sense that there would not have been a business without him. He wasn't one of many influencers that we used as part of the strategy. He was the only distribution channel that we had. So in that sense, he was a partner. In a literal sense, he was not. He didn't own any equity. He never invested. I never gave him money. It was just kind of a rev share agreement. But yeah, I did have trepidation, which is why I structured it like that. I had trepidation walking into his house.
I bet, with the bodyguards and the assault rifles. It had to have been quite an experience to just be part of that whole scene.
Yes, it was.
So you've since started a Bitcoin mining company. Like, how did that come about? Like, did you toss aside like all the altcoin stuff and like you're focused strictly on Bitcoin now? Because I know you're like a big Bitcoin guy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So the crypto company died in 2019. And then in 2021, Bitcoin was booming again. It was the next cycle, right? And China had banned mining in the summer of 2021 overnight. And so the difficulty rate plummeted, which meant mining became extremely profitable, like very profitable. And so all of us enterprising Americans, such as myself, latched onto that. And we started looking for ways to mine Bitcoin. And so I started looking for facilities, for places to lease that had heavy power on site. And I was striking out until I finally found a place 30 minutes from home for sale. And I reached out to the seller directly, and I bought the facility from him. When I say I bought the facility, it wasn't a business. There was no LLC. There were no employees. It was just a lease in a rented building that I'm sitting in right now that already had all of the infrastructure and transformers on site to enable hundreds of Bitcoin miners immediately, which was very hard to find, especially at the time.
Did you have any miners at all at that point?
The facility did come with miners. So what I bought came with miners that were mining Bitcoin directly, but we took that asset and we turned it into a company, which is today Mining Syndicate. So we basically spent a lot of money for access to a lease and infrastructure and a handful of miners that were netting like 15 grand a month at the time. We knew that was very short lived because they were late model miners. We sold the miners because we didn't want to be in the mining business. We wanted to be in the hardware and in the hosting business.
So say more about that. So how you're not selling, tell me more about that.
Bitcoin.
You don't mine Bitcoin. You are selling, you're like a server basically.
We sell, so if you, let's say you wanted to mine Bitcoin, we would sell you a $5,000 machine, which would mine you like, call it $12 a day in profit of Bitcoin. And then we would sell you the electricity and the services, which would be about 200 bucks a month. So we make most of our money selling that machine. And then we kind of break even on the hosting. That's our business.
So had you done any of your like mining on your own prior to this? Like, did you have any experience at all doing your own mining of Bitcoin?
I had almost no experience, which never, you know, detracts me for better or worse. I had bought two miners from eBay throughout this whole process to learn. I plugged them in. I was like, okay, I'm an expert. But no, I didn't have much experience at all.
And Texas is kind of a hotbed for mining, isn't it, right now? So what's on the horizon for the, I mean, let's talk a little bit more about Bitcoin. I mean, it's something you have strong conviction in. Do you make any price predictions in the, for this coming?
Yeah, I can make predictions, but I've never been good at them. To me, Bitcoin is just math, which is why I like it. It's provable scarcity, which not even gold has. We think gold is scarce, but we don't know how scarce it is, right? So I think Bitcoin is a gold replacement, not a gold killer, but just a superior alternative to gold that will eventually overtake gold's market cap, which would mean one Bitcoin would be like $300,000 or $400,000 each. I think it's a statistical inevitability that Bitcoin will hit 100 grand and then $1 million each. Is it going to be in months or years or decades? I don't know. I do think we'll hit 100 grand this cycle over the next 18 months and maybe even 150 or two.
And so you do not trade in and out of positions with Bitcoin, like you buy, you hold, and you hodl, as they say, right?
Yes, I'm so bad at like investing in stocks that, but what I am good at though, is I'm good at never selling. It did take years to learn that. So if I buy a stock, I will never sell that stock. If I buy Bitcoin or Ethereum, I will never sell it because the pain that I feel from selling too early is much greater than the pain I feel from losing money.
Right. I read, wasn't one of your first investments Circuit City?
Yep. That was my first investment.
It was your first, and that was a pretty big loss, wasn't it?
At the time, it was a third of my net worth, which was a whopping $500.
Right.
So I was 21, but I have foregone a lot more money selling things too early. Like when the last time I did that and the last time I will ever do that was in March of 2020 when I freaked out and I sold all my stocks. Nope, I don't like where this is going. And you name it.
Yeah.
Like Nvidia, Tesla, Shopify. Like, need I say more? I'm like, my Tesla has already tripled. I'm going to sell it now. Yeah. I had 8x more to go after that.
Right. Yeah. It's painful. My brother did the same thing. He panicked and yeah, it's huge upside that you end up missing out on.
Yeah. I don't do that anymore. Like I've held Bitcoin at 85% drops. Like I don't sell.
How do you deal with the volatility? Like, you know, the drop from, let's say 60, whatever it was, 67,000 down to 15 or 16,000. How do you think about that psychologically? How does it affect you?
I use friction wherever I can. So there's a lot of friction between me and being able to sell Bitcoin. Passwords, two-factor authentication.
Multi-sig setup or something.
All of it. Yeah. And I just don't like, honestly, when I sold Bitcoin too early, when I sold those stocks, that was when I was more of a speculator and not a believer. Yeah. And I think Bitcoin's going to be here forever, right? And so I would sell it to pay the mortgage or to feed my family. Like I'm not stupid, but I don't sell it even if it's dropping 80%. I just can't. I'm not good at timing it and I don't want to get good at timing it. So I don't think about it. So I don't sell it.
Let's take a quick break and hear from today's sponsors.
Hey everyone, it's Patrick, your host of Millennial Investing. Every year, my buddies and I do a guy's trip to escape the cold and dreary Ohio winters. Once we pick our destination, without fail, we all jump on Airbnb and find an incredible place to stay. We just got back from an amazing trip in Palm Springs, California, and our Airbnb home was a huge part of creating memories we'll never forget. I loved it so much, I'm taking my family back to Palm Springs for spring break, and we're staying in an Airbnb home my kids fell in love with and picked out themselves. While I was there, I had the realization that my own home could be an Airbnb. It's an excellent way to earn some extra cash, whether you're saving up for your next vacation, paying off some bills, or investing. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host. That's airbnb.com/host. Quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on multiple systems, on delivering your product or service, the more margin you have and the more money you keep. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, HR into one platform and one source of truth. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required, accessed from anywhere. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified business management suite. You improve efficiency by bringing all your major business processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move. So do the math. See how you'll profit with NetSuite. Everything seems to be more expensive these days. I've noticed this at my own businesses that I've run. You'd be wise to find proven ways to cut costs and boost performance at the same time. By popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/MI. netsuite.com/MI. That's netsuite.com/MI. Hey guys, when it comes to financial advice, you've got to trust the source. It's why you listen to this podcast. When I'm looking to upgrade my wallet, I turn to NerdWallet. Their expert team of nerds dives into the details to help you find smarter financial products. Before NerdWallet, I'd pay for vacations with whatever credit card was in my wallet. But I was missing out on miles I didn't even know I was leaving on the table. Now I've got a new card with more miles and more upgrades. What could future you do with more travel rewards? A hotel upgrade? Lounge access? A free flight to a bucket list destination? Wherever you go next, make it happen with a smarter travel credit card. Don't wait to make smart financial decisions. Compare and find smarter credit cards, savings accounts, and much more today at nerdwallet.com. NerdWallet, finance smarter. Check out nerdwallet.com and start making smarter financial decisions. As with all cards, credit is subject to lender approval and terms apply.
All right, back to the show.
I think that's smart. I want to get into real estate a little bit. Talk to me about like your first real estate deal. How did you first get turned on to real estate? Because I know that's one of your passions too.
I first got into real estate in 2008. Great timing. At the time, Obama instituted the first-time homebuyer tax credit. Mm-hmm. You remember that?
I do.
And it was $8,000. And he changed it eventually to be like, a tax deduction. But in the beginning, it was a check to your bank, right? And as a 21-year-old with $500 to my name, that was very attractive. Mm-hmm. And so I got home from my mission at 21, and I just felt like I could take on the world. I had all the confidence in the world. And so I started reading all the business books and all the real estate books. And I started college and I wanted to be a homeowner. And I didn't have any money. So my wife and I started waiting tables. We were in Tuscaloosa, Alabama. And we, 7 months into marriage, we bought a 3-bedroom, 1-bath house in Tuscaloosa for $90,000. And it had been sitting on the market forever. And we didn't know what we were doing. We used the same broker that was listing it, you know, to buy it. She said, oh, the sellers won't budge on price, so don't even ask. So we're like, oh, okay, whatever you say. And like, it had been sitting for a year at the same price. And right. they definitely would have come down on price. I didn't know what I was doing. Anyway, we bought the house, we moved into it. We got $8,000 from Obama. We took that and we bought a rental house 5 minutes away. And those were our first two homes.
And that has since led to mobile home parks, right?
So that led to a third rental house. And then I moved to Dallas, Texas, and I partnered with a couple guys. We bought a small RV park in Oklahoma, and then we bought 24 more mobile home and or RV parks over the next 2 years. We sold the portfolio in 2021, and then I started buying them with Nick, my partner at Co-Founders, last year. And then I'm also a GP on some deals occasionally with other partners as well.
So what is it about mobile home parks that you like? Are you doing value adds when you buy them?
I love it because you're really buying land and you're maintaining the infrastructure under the land and not the houses itself, which most people don't realize that. They think, oh, a mobile home park, it's going to have all these maintenance issues. Yes, if you own the mobile homes, but that's not what we do. So we will buy a park and sometimes the tenants own the homes, sometimes the park owns the homes. Regardless, after closing on the park, we will give or sell the homes back to the tenants if they want them. If they don't want them, then we will give them plenty of time to move. And then we take a hit on the top line revenue, but we don't really have to manage anything after that. We just own the land and rent it out.
So is this something you're looking to add more mobile homes to your portfolio, or are you kind of tapped out right now?
It's kind of a passive thing. So people DM me deals, and if they're attractive, then sometimes I'll just assign them to someone else, or occasionally we'll buy one ourselves. But it's not something I'm really looking to scale, but I'm also not avoiding it right now either.
So I want to hear about like an average day for you. You're creating a bunch of content. You're writing 30 or 40,000 words a week, I believe. You've got the holding company co-founders, all these businesses underneath it. How are you running like an average day for you while still maintaining a family, a wife, all of that?
Yeah. So an average day for me is I wake up at like 6 or so, and I just shower and go straight to the office, one of two offices, and I just start working. I drink caffeine and I just put on my AirPods, put on something in the background, and I'll get to inbox zero right away. I will just knock out a to-do list. I will write a long form tweet, and I'll kind of hop from helping my operators, hop on calls with them impromptu, and I'll write content. I'll write my newsletter, and I leave my calendar pretty much empty most of the time. I just don't like structured meetings, and I'll tackle fires one at a time. And I'll do that until about 6 p.m. And then I'll come home and I'll eat dinner with my family every night. Like, there's never really a reason to miss dinner. I don't travel that much. And then I'll take the boys to basketball practice. I'll usually work in the car while they're practicing. And then I come home, hang out with the kids, put them in bed. And then I'll watch something with my wife. And sometimes I'll have the computer open and I watch Love is Blind.
Tell me about Parkinson's Law. What is Parkinson's Law and how does it affect your life?
Parkinson's Law states that work expands to fill the time allotted to it. Back to high school, if you had a big, huge project due 3 months from now, you're probably going to get it done the night before, and it's probably going to be great. At least that's how I work. Whereas if you only have an hour to do something, then you'll get it done in that hour. And so the same principle is true with Elon buying Twitter and firing 80% of people, and it just keeps going. And then the same principle is true with just taking on way too many projects and too many people. Or too many companies. So I just kind of let the most important things bubble their way to the surface. If I let something slip, if I, forget to do something, then that's just a message to me that it wasn't that important. I'm not going to forget my family, right? That's not in my work bucket. So that's the most important. And then if there's a big fire, like an investor, we're raising money, that just lives in the top of my head and it will get done. And everything else, like whatever my time kind of gravitate towards, is what's most important. Because it's what I'm placing importance in, and everything else just falls to the wayside. And maybe I pick it back up in a month when it's more important then, or maybe I never pick it back up. But I used to fight that, right? And just really try to hone in on one thing. This works really well for me. And it's what I love doing. And honestly, it doesn't feel like work. 12-hour days every day. It's no different than a 9-to-5 guy working 6 hours at the office and then fishing 6 hours if that's what he loves. Like, it all feels like play to me.
Stephen Covey is a Mormon and he's got the Franklin planner that I used to really be into. My wife actually is still into the Franklin planner. She carries it around. It's like a big, massive, bigger than a telephone, old telephone book. And she lives her entire life by that. Is that something you utilize to like kind of structure things and keep track of things and prioritize?
No. So I have a very low tech system. I have Chrome tabs open. And if it's an open tab, then it's a to-do list. A few Google Sheets that I leave pinned in Chrome at all times that I'm always referring to. I've got my reminders app on my iPhone. And then I have unread emails and unread texts. And that's everything that I need to do. I have a calendar, right? For like stuff like this podcast. But most days, there's one or two things in my calendar. It's something that I've taught for years. But now I've just stuck with it because it works.
I want to get into idea generation. You've got a ton of ideas that you come up with, whether it's businesses or tweets that you're, you know, threads that you're writing. Talk to me about that creative process. Where do you come up with ideas, or where's like the fertilizer, the source of some of these ideas come from?
I don't know. It's like, I consider it like the 10,000 hour rule, right? Like when my work is my hobby and it's all that I do outside of my family, then I just see things everywhere. And I thought of this analogy a little while ago. Like, I'm not a musician at all. I would like to be. I love music. I played the guitar a little bit, but it is my bucket list item to like have a hit song. Like, I think that would be awesome. But like the thought of writing a song is just so foreign to me, right? Whereas some people are like, I don't have ideas. Like, how do you think of these ideas? And so I think of Taylor Swift, and she has hundreds of songs, maybe thousands that we don't even know about. And they just flow. She'll just see something outside and write a song. And it's just because that's all she is. That's all she knows. That's all she sees and thinks about. Her brain is wired in that way. And it's trained to be wired in that way. And that's just how I am. Like, I don't know. I don't try to think of ideas. I don't have like a process. I just see things out there. And I think I just attach like commerce to it or business to it. Like, oh, this could be improved by, oh, you could monetize it like that. Like, that's just how my brain works.
I find it fascinating. Is that why you've partnered with some of these like college and MBA students? Because you've got so many ideas that you want to pursue, and you give them free rein and let them run with it?
Yeah, exactly. I've like the Fast Tree Care. I bought fasttreecare.com, the domain, like 6 years ago. And I just kept renewing it. I was like, that is a good domain. How is that not taken? And I had helped a friend as a favor start his tree business, and it went amazingly. And so I thought, all right, that's just idea number 72. And one day the stars will align or not. And if they do, then I'll launch this business. And it did. And it's a great business, and it's a great domain name, and it's awesome. And so co-founders is a vehicle for me to plant those ideas with other people. And because, you know, people tell me a lot, like, what if you just did one thing? It's like, well, I do one thing, and it's start businesses. I don't do one business because like, I wouldn't enjoy that.
Do you find Andrew Wilkinson of Tiny, I think he made the comment that it's like the Pareto's law, 80-20 rule, that 80% or what, 20% of your companies are generating 80% of the revenue. Do you find that to be the case?
Absolutely. Yeah.
So is that Bitcoin mining? Is that Texas Snacks?
Yeah. Like, right now it's Bitcoin mining, just because it's the most established, and we're selling a high ticket item. So to have a $100,000 day means we just have to sell 20 items. That kind of makes it easier to be a bigger business. But co-founders is very new. Like, our AI startup is 4 months old. Our RV park is 8 months old. Texas Snacks is old, but that's just kind of, that's like a $3 or $4 million business. And then Mining Syndicate. And then, yeah. So I don't know what that 80-20 will look like in the future, but yeah.
I want to kind of shift gears a little bit. You used to be a pretty heavy dude. 260, you said. You're not that anymore. So talk to me about that process of getting into ultra marathons and losing a bunch of weight and just the training that was involved in that. Like, you had a comment with Chris Powers who was like something about the importance of seeking out and finding hard things to do, which I'm totally in agreement with. Like, make yourself suffer goes against our grain. Tell me about the ultra marathon stuff.
Yeah. So I celebrated my 10-year anniversary in 2008 with my wife. And I was this size when I got married. I was this exact size all throughout high school, throughout my mission. And then I got home and I got married and I just let myself go. And I gained 50, 60 pounds. And my wife, bless her heart, never once said a word. She's not the type. Hey, you know, watch what you're eating. Like, what are you doing? Like, man, maybe you should work out. Never, ever once.
Really?
She just loved me.
Yeah.
Never. And she never gained a pound. She had four kids and like, she always just lost it and then had another kid. And so she's the same size today that she was in high school. And so despite her never saying anything, we were on our 10-year anniversary and I just looked in the mirror and I was like, what are you doing? What? Who are you? Like, what? Nothing. Like, there wasn't a person that made a comment. I don't know what the trigger was. It was just, I hit a point. And I was like, this is unsustainable. And I had, you know, I had tried over the years half-heartedly, lost 20 pounds, gained it, lost 30, lost 10. But I was like, no, I'm done. And I had heard about keto, but I didn't know anything about it. And I was like, let's try that. All right. When I come home from Hawaii, our anniversary, it's like, I'm going to start keto. So I did. And I just didn't look back. I just went strict keto. I lost all the weight and I didn't really do much exercise. It was just diet. I played racquetball kind of just a little bit on the weekends. But after I lost the weight, I hit my goal weight and I was like, okay, now you got to keep this off. I didn't want to be on keto forever. So I thought, I'll just start running. So I just went outside and I don't have a background in running. I wrestled in high school and that's it. So I just started running around the neighborhood. And I'd always told myself I never ran a race. I'm the all or nothing type. And so I thought, man, it'd be a cool story if my first race was a marathon. It'd just be cool to not work up to it. That's the extent of my thinking. And so I just Googled a marathon training plan. I followed it to a T. I ran a marathon 2.5 months later. And then I learned what ultra marathons were. I didn't even know they existed. And I ran an ultra marathon a month after that. And then I ran 13 more over the next 2 years.
So an ultra marathon is, what's the shortest mileage?
50K, which is 31 miles.
And what's the longest you, what was the longest one you did?
139.
So something like that takes how long?
35 hours.
Holy smokes. That's crazy.
Yeah, it is. It's pretty crazy.
I mean, that's wild. I biked across America. That was like my big journey. Like, so I appreciate.
Yeah, that's pretty wild.
No, I appreciate these kind of stories and I think they're great to seek out, but I can't imagine running whatever, 36 hours, 30, however long, you know, like that blows my mind, honestly.
Yeah. I mean, at the end of the day, it comes down to dialing in your nutrition. And I mean that while you're running, right? Like you got to learn like how many calories you need per hour to keep going. Just like how much gas your car needs every 100 miles, right? And then you got to dial in your, you got to take electrolytes. That's the big secret. You just got to have your salt, potassium, magnesium. And then the third is you just can't quit. Like you just
right.
walk.
That's not an option, right?
You just, no, it's just not. And you walk a lot. So you say running, but there's, in a lot of ultras, there's more walking than running.
Are you sleeping, like taking a little cat nap along the way or?
No, I never have. People do. It's common on like, especially multi, like 100 to 200 or 300 mile races, but I've never had.
Is it something you would do that level of distance again? Or is it like a one and done? Like I did it. I proved I could do it. I don't need to do it again.
I would. I definitely would. I never quit one, which I've since learned is rare. It's, they have like a 30 to 40% dropout rate, which makes sense. I just, on the 140 mile one, I remember being out there. And like, it was the hardest thing I've ever done in my life by far.
Yeah.
And I wanted to quit. I just thought, I have four kids and they're going to ask me why I quit. And I can't tell them, well, daddy broke his leg. Right. You know, daddy got bit by a snake. I just have to tell them it was too hard. And that was the only reason I just couldn't do it. I couldn't quit. And they would have been like, yeah, of course it's hard. Right. It's like, I couldn't stomach them remembering that even if they never did, like, I just couldn't do it.
No, it's a great example to set for them. I want to get more into your kids. You've got a daughter that had a lung transplant, and this story is really amazing. So tell me a little bit about her, the condition she had, and then what led to the lung transplant, and then we'll kind of go from there.
Yeah, she had a disease called pulmonary hypertension, which means a high blood pressure in the lungs. It's extremely rare, especially if it's idiopathic, which means the doctors don't know the cause for it. Sometimes older smokers will get it, but it's very rare to be born with it, one in a million rare. And so we didn't even know she had it until she was three. She just kept having breathing issues. She was misdiagnosed with asthma. And then finally, our pediatrician was just like, maybe it's pulmonary hypertension. And like that just set off this chain of events. And so she was diagnosed with it. We'd never heard of it. And we learned it was terminal. There's medication you can take. So basically what it means is the arteries in her lungs are too narrow. She was born that way. And so the heart works on overdrive 24/7. To push it through. So her resting heart rate was in the 120s to 150s.
Oh, wow.
24/7.
Right.
So couldn't climb upstairs. Her lips, everyone thought she wore purple lipstick because her lips are always blue. And so from 3 to 9, it just got worse. And she'd be on oxygen sometimes. Sometimes she had, we were in a trial in Denver. Like we tried everything, but we, you know, there's no cure. And so at age 9, the doctor's like, listen, she needs a double lung transplant. That's the only way out of this. And it's not really out of it because lungs don't last forever. But it was just the best option. And so we had to move to Houston to be close to the Texas Children's, which is the best lung hospital in the country. And she was on the waiting list for 6 weeks. And we got a call late at night and we took her in and she got a lung transplant. And it's been 2 years almost to the day.
Wow.
And she's been healthy ever since.
That's incredible. Super incredible. And so what is the, will she have to have, you said there's a time limit on lung transplants. Will she have to have another one in her 20s or something like that?
So the first year is the riskiest, mm-hmm. and we got out of that. And so average lifespan of lungs is like 7 to 10 years.
Yeah.
And so doctors will do a second transplant if all of the stars align, if they say it's okay. You know, it happens in a minority of cases. So that's kind of the hope, is a double, like a second lung transplant at some point in the future.
My wife's father had a idiopathic is the term, right? Idiopathic lung issue, and also had a lung transplant. And same thing, you know, gave him 5 to 10 years. And I think, you know, he was older when he had the transplant. He was in his late 60s, I think, when the transplant happened, but was able to get a lot more years than he probably otherwise would have. So you since have become a donor. So talk to me about you and your wife and what you guys have done, you know, trying to give back to, I guess, thank the little boy that saved your daughter's life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So a month or two after she got her transplant, I learned about living organ donation, which basically means donating a portion of your liver, because livers actually regenerate. You only have one, but it will regenerate. So donating a portion of your liver, or donating one of your two kidneys, or donating blood marrow. And so I learned about, I didn't even know it was a thing. I just thought you'd be, you know, an organ donor on your driver's license. And I had learned about doing it altruistically, which, or also known as non-directed, where you just give it to a stranger. And it only happens a couple hundred times a year.
Nationwide, just that people choose to do this, you're saying?
Yeah. There's about 4,000 kidney donations a year, and about 95% of them are to a loved one.
Okay.
The rest are non-directed.
Right.
So I had just felt immense gratitude to Sam, the boy who tragically died and gave my daughter his lungs, and I wanted to pay it forward. It seemed like a very logical way to do it once I learned about how low risk of a procedure that it is.
Yeah. You told me it's like a colonoscopy or a giving birth or something, like about the same odds of...
About 3 in 10,000 mortality rate.
And what was the stat I read that if just 1 in 10,000 people did this kind of kidney donation, there would be, tell me about that. I don't know the exact numbers.
Yeah. So I kind of had to back end into this math myself. Once I learned it, I just like, wow, the McAfee story, I just wanted to shout it from the rooftops. If 1 in every 10,000 healthy American adults, so not just Americans, not just adults, but like healthy American adults, were to donate their kidney, then no one would die waiting for a kidney. Whereas today, about 5,000 people a year die on the transplant list.
Wow. And your wife also did the same procedure. You and your wife both gave a kidney and went through this process?
Yep. Just 2 weeks ago.
2 weeks ago, she did hers. Wow. That's incredible. So to find out more about it, I think you mentioned a organization or a website. What was that?
Yeah, the National Kidney Registry. I think it's like NKR, kidneyregistry.org.
I'll put links in the show notes to this. I'm interested in it. I don't know that I really admire people that do something like this. So pretty cool stuff. Before we wrap up, is there anything that we didn't touch on that you wanted to talk about?
No, I don't think so. We had talked about this earlier, where I'm doing this, a live call-in show. I kind of call it the Dave Ramsey for entrepreneurs, where
I love it.
Yeah. People can call in and just ask me business questions live on Twitter through Twitter Spaces. So,
and you've done one so far. You're planning to do 10. Is that what you said?
I'm going to do 10 as an experiment to see how it goes. And yeah, it's on Twitter at noon every Friday, and you can call in through Twitter and just ask me any business question, and I'll answer it live on the spot.
That's awesome. I think it's a great idea. How do people find you on Twitter? How can they find you elsewhere online? What's the best way for people to sign up for the Spaces thing and just learn more about you?
Probably on my website. It's chrisjkerner.com, K-O-E-R-N-E-R. On Twitter, I'm MHP_guy, as in mobile home park guy. Pretty active there.
Awesome. Chris, thanks so much for your time. This has been a lot of fun. I really appreciate your time today.
Absolutely. Thanks, Patrick.
Okay, folks, that's all I had for today's episode. I hope you enjoyed the show, and I'll see you back here real soon.
Thank you for listening to TIP. Make sure to follow Millennial Investing on your favorite podcast app and never miss out on our episodes. To access our show notes, transcripts, or courses, go to theinvestorspodcast.com. This show is for entertainment purposes only. Before making any decision, consult a professional. This show is copyrighted by the Investors Podcast Network. Written permission must be granted before syndication or rebroadcasting.